From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If you've filled up, you know it. Gas prices jumped an average of 18 cents a gallon in the last week alone. That is the biggest jump since the Energy Department began compiling data 15 years ago. The average price of a gallon of gas is now $2.55, $3 and change in some parts of the country. Crude oil prices, the biggest component of gasoline prices, topped $67 a barrel at the end of last week. So far, Americans are still hitting the roads, but more carefully, and driving is just the beginning of what high oil makes more expensive. After a decade of binging on mega cars and mega houses, the oil bill is coming due with a vengeance. This hour on Point, skyrocketing oil prices and what they portend for the economy and the way Americans live. You can join the conversation. Are you feeling it? Have you driven away from the gas station stunned? Is this the wake-up call for new science, new policy, new lifestyles? Are you ready for the wallop of high oil? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Vijay Vaitheswaran, global environment and energy correspondent for The Economist magazine. He wrote about perils at the pump in this week's issue. He's author of Power to the People, How the Coming Energy Revolution Will Transform an Industry, Change Our Lives, and Maybe Even Save the Planet. Vijay, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guest.
Vijay, take us into the big picture here. What's going on? We've got a general idea, but nail it down for us. What is happening with these very high oil prices?
What you have is a perfect storm in a way, and it's something that we haven't seen in oil really in history. It's this, the analogy with the 1970s. Some people might remember the oil shocks of the 70s, mm-hmm. of course. Is actually not a very good one. At that time, what we had was political turbulence in the Middle East, dramatic political turbulence in terms of the Iranian Revolution, for example, the Arab embargo, physically disrupting supplies of oil. That's not what's going on, and that's what's quite so interesting. We've seen oil prices go up from a low of $10 a barrel back in 1999 to now in the mid-60s, heading towards $70 a barrel. Extraordinary rise without actually seeing a major disruption. This is what's truly breathtaking, and that's what has caught a lot of people off guard.
So take us into the fundamentals here. There's the risk of disruption. We saw last week when President Bush talked about all options on the table with Iran, when Saudi Arabia was worried about the terrorist attacks there. Those potential disruptions do seem to have an effect, but they're just one piece of the picture.
There's two levels to look at the oil market. You always have to look at supply and demand, of course. At one level, it's a commodity market. Prices go up, prices go down. Supply and demand are essential components, right? You have to look at that level. And when you look at it, supply is tight. And demand, especially coming from a new quarter, that is China. Mm. China and India more generally, the rising Asian tigers, have come on strong in the last few years. And the United States, of course, has continued to become to be the engine of the world economy. We're the Goliath of oil consumption. A quarter of all the world's oil comes to this economy, and that has continued to be true. So, at a time when global supplies have grown tighter, demand has continued to be extraordinarily strong, unexpectedly strong. In any commodity market, whether it's for bauxite or for bananas, you would find prices would be tight and going higher at a time like that. The extra factor that's special to oil, that's different, that makes oil unique among commodity markets, is that there's a special thing called, of course, the OPEC oil cartel. This is not like any other market for commodity products. And the Saudi Arabian regime has tried to behave in the past as something like a central bank for oil, and that is they've tried to moderate oil prices. Even though the cartel generally tries to prop prices of oil higher than they would be in a free market, the Saudis have always been the voice of moderation, and they did this by keeping a lot of spare capacity around. That is 5, 8, 10 million barrels a day worth of capacity paid for, ready to go, but that they kept just on hold, hanging around. Mm-hmm. And whenever there was a crisis, for example, the Iran-Iraq war, the first Gulf war, when a couple of years ago Venezuela had a major political crisis that shut down 2 million barrels a day of oil, The Saudis quietly stepped up their production, didn't make a big noise about it. They stepped into the world market with 2 million barrels a day of oil, and they saved the world from a crisis.
So why don't they do that now? Why aren't they doing that?
Excellent question. The central bank has run out of its spare capacity. In other words, the demand from China and other places has been so strong at the same time that OPEC hasn't been investing enough to upgrade its supplies. They've got the oil in the ground. In my opinion, there's no serious question that there's plenty of oil left in the world. But OPEC has not been investing enough in the last 10-15 years to keep up with the dramatic growth from Asia especially.
Vijay, let me ask you about a temporary imbalance.
The central bank can't act like the central bank right now. And as long as that's true, we're going to have a lot of nervousness in the markets and prices can go even higher yet without a major crisis.
China's growth has been astounding, and yet it wasn't entirely unanticipated. Why hasn't OPEC, why hasn't Saudi Arabia invested in more capacity?
They're beginning to do so now. And in fact, when the crown prince, who is now the king, of course, the Saudi king recently passed away, but really the guy who's running the place now, Abdullah, has been running the show for the last decade or so. He came to visit President Bush a few months back in Texas. The two gentlemen are good friends. They held hands. They talked about old friendships and so on. Well, one thing he promised President Bush was that the Saudis will spend tens of billions of dollars to dramatically increase their capacity over the next 5 to 7 years so that they can build up that spare capacity again. And there is actually there are a lot of skeptics out there. But in fact, talking as I do to the people in the oil industry, they have in fact increased their rig counts. They're spending the money to try to do this. But it will take time. It doesn't happen overnight. There's a lag effect in oil. It's going to take 18 months to 2 years to try to build that back up. Meanwhile, America and China in particular, we're continuing to guzzle oil like crazy. It's not like we're slowing down. Mm-hmm. So it's like running up the down escalator.
So let's talk very materially for a moment. People have seen these enormous prices at the gas pump, not enormous by European standards, but high by American standards. Are those likely to go on? Is oil likely to climb up to 70, 80? We even see people speculating about $100 a barrel oil. What do you anticipate?
I think that all bets are off in oil right now. Especially, for example, if you see a major attack in Saudi Arabia, a terrorist attack by al-Qaeda. And let's remember, Osama bin Laden has specifically said that oil infrastructure is a target of of al-Qaeda. He and his radical cohorts believe that the oil in the Middle East is being somehow usurped by the Saudi regime and by Americans. And so they have made it very clear they're going to target oil infrastructure. So if we see a major attack on important Saudi infrastructure, not just bombs here or there, but in the important stuff, then I think we could easily see prices go past $100, even $150 a barrel. But that's quite different from what we've seen in the last couple of years, which is much more gradual. And the difference is when you have prices that rise gradually, the economies of the world have a time to adjust. And in fact, we haven't seen a crisis behavior. We haven't seen what we saw in the 70s, for example, panicking, people hoarding, queues and rationing, that kind of thing. A lot of the harm that was done in the 1970s was actually not due to an actual shortage of oil. The oil was there in the world. It was due to the panicking and hoarding and the panicking mentality, as well as some of the government policies like price controls and some of the misguided policies that were in place. So we've learned some lessons, of course, we can talk about from the 70s, but we're not there yet. And it all depends on how and why prices rise.
And yet the vice keeps squeezing and squeezing higher here so far. Jack Beatty, there it is, tremendous demand, huge risk factors right now. It seems like the new ones every day as the geopolitics get more complicated, and those prices heading up and up, a kind of oil alarm clock to the world here.
Yes, and already feeding down into the most prosaic items of daily life. Domino Pizza has just added a $1 surcharge in most of its markets to deliver pizza. Airlines, $20 to $87 surcharges. Federal Express, 12% surcharges for air shipments, 2.5% for ground shipments. And that's probably just the beginning of how this is going to percolate down and affect people. And meanwhile, with any development, you always have to ask, who benefits? Well, Chevron Texaco in the first quarter of this year, profits up 294%. ExxonMobil, 125%. Meanwhile, the administration passes an energy bill. And what will this bill do? Well, according to the Energy Information Administration, part of the administration, it will increase gas prices and oil demand by 14% by 2010. Meanwhile, the president, far from opening the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to try to increase supply, is still filling that reserve. And, of course, the energy bill has tax cuts of tax credits of $25,000 for Hummers and $2,000 for hybrids. So this sort of supply and demand is also benefiting people. And the administration, Bush has said in the past, casually, you know, basically, what's so bad about high energy prices? That's the outlook of the oil regions. And so eventually, we hope we can get some action out of the government. But the president says, well, I can't do anything about these prices. His father tapped the Strategic Petroleum Reserve in 1991. Bill Clinton did it. So this can be done. It's just that the administration has no will to do it.
Not right now. Jack, Vijay, please stand by. There's a lot more we're going to dig into this hour. We're talking about skyrocketing oil prices and their impact, about sticker shock at the pump. You can join us. Are you feeling it? Have you driven away from the gas pump stunned? Have you pulled the bicycle out of the shed? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about skyrocketing oil prices and their impact. You cannot miss them at the gas pump, and they are bleeding out everywhere right now. You can join the conversation. Are you rewriting your budget to accommodate high oil? Should the government be doing something? What? And now that America's bought into big cars and big houses and distant suburbs, how does the country, how should the country respond? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined this morning today by our own Jack Beatty from New York, by Vijay Vaitheeswaran, energy correspondent for The Economist magazine. We're joined also now from New York by John Kilduff. He's senior vice president in the Energy Risk Management Group at FEMOT, a global brokerage firm. John, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Good morning.
So you advise, I assume, big industry clients. What are you telling them? Watch out below. The prices are just headed up. How are you advising the risk side of the oil price spiral we seem to be in?
Well, basically, as you were talking about earlier, you know, there is no shortage of oil right now. It's pretty easy at this point, actually, based upon our historic analysis of inventory levels of crude oil and gasoline and other commodities, to argue for a price that, for crude oil, just to put it out there, in the mid-40s, really.
Well, when you say no shortage, John, I just want to understand what you mean. Do you mean in the ground or in the tankers or waiting to be refined? Where is there no shortage?
I mean, in commercial inventories here in the United States, they're all above their 3-, 5-, and 10-year averages. In terms of supply levels, and also we have about 54 days of forward cover now globally in the OECD countries, which is a above average cover as well.
So what's going on?
Well, what's going on is that the demand forecasts for this upcoming fourth quarter are off the charts. Basically, that it's almost an insatiable type of amount, that we're going to see a production deficit to the tune of about 2 million barrels per day that's going to generate incredible tightness that will leave us even more vulnerable, or actually vulnerable, as opposed to the perceived vulnerability that's being priced in right now.
So you're talking about not just current demand, but you're saying that there's more than enough oil right now for a much lower price, but the demand in the fourth quarter right in front of us is so much greater than demand right now that it will outstrip the availability?
It will outstrip there will be a deficit. We will chew through the robust inventories that I'm referring to right now.
Is this all about China? How can demand spike so much just in one quarter?
Well, it's about the winter fuel demand in particular here in the Northern Hemisphere. It is also about China and India, as was talked about earlier. If there was a surprise for the energy markets in 2004, it was the double-digit increase that came for demand out of China. But also Japan chipped in with 3 to 5% demand growth, Germany as well. And here in the U.S., we've been consuming at bigger and bigger and even record paces at times.
So where do you think we're headed, John? Is this situation sustainable? Does demand have to fall through global recession? Are new supplies somehow going to come on stream that will keep up with it? When are prices going to come down? Will they?
Well, I think they probably will come down. And I will tell you that there's been a lot of talk lately that the economy has been shrugging off these high energy prices. What's been happening though is that over the past year and a half now, when we've had record gasoline prices twice before, we've had soft patches in the economy, most recently earlier this year. I think you saw Walmart this morning come out and warn about third quarter strains on their business because of gasoline prices, and there's been a litany really now of anecdotal evidence coming out that we are going to see some impact on the consumer, which is two-thirds of the U.S. economy now with these record gasoline prices again. And I think that could help foster lower prices. Also, the demand estimates for this fourth quarter have been being drawn down over the course of the past several months as well by the IEA, the International Energy Administration, our own Department of Energy, and even OPEC is seeing a softening of demand, particularly out of China. Matter of fact, Chinese demand has been in a deficit on some measures for the first 6 months of the year on crude oil and some other refined products because they're allowing price increases to be passed through to their consumers and doing some other things to sort of stave off the high energy prices. So to the extent that these spectacular demand fears don't materialize, in my view, in the fourth quarter, I think we can see a fall then in prices at that time.
So you're looking for potentially more growth in prices, but maybe a corner to be turned ahead. We hear the advice that you're giving your clients there. John Kilduff in New York, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
John Kilduff, Senior Vice President in Energy Risk Management at FEMAT. Vijay, what about these prices currently in historical terms? We look at the charts, and the 90s looks like it was an incredible bargain basement for energy, for oil. You look back, of course, the late 70s, early 80s, tremendous spikes. And then way back in the 20th century, 30s and 40s, much higher prices than Americans have grown accustomed to paying. So in real terms, constant dollar terms, over the decades, are these really bad prices that we're seeing right now?
You make a very good point. When we adjust for inflation, of course, the current record prices are not record prices, really. We have seen higher prices, and within the lifetimes of people listening to our program during the oil shocks and so on during the 70s. That's not very comforting to anybody who's filling up their gasoline tank, and for people who are listening in parts of the country that might have $3 gasoline, that sticker shock. I mean, you know, Americans, I think, genetically, were born thinking that gasoline should be $1 a gallon. I don't know why that is, but people seem to have an intuition that anything above that we're being gouged. And, you know, I feel the same way. I grew up in New England but on the open road with feeling that we're entitled to cheap gasoline. But when we actually think about it, the price of gasoline, until very recently, hasn't kept pace with the price of almost anything else that's in American society, any price of milk or bread or anything else. In fact, never mind the cost of gasoline in Europe where they have a lot of taxes. If you go into any gasoline station in America, again, until very recently, gasoline was probably the cheapest liquid you could buy in there.
Right.
And so that just tells you something about our own expectations.
And yet, when it goes up, it hurts. And at some point, you can have economic consequences that are very large. I want to begin to bring our callers in. Dwayne is calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Dwayne, what do you see? What do you think?
Good morning. It's an honor to be on your program. I work in the transportation industry, and I'm what you call a professional driver, which is a technical term for a trucker.
Got it. Great. Good to have you. And what do you see out there, Dwayne?
Well, you know, I was an owner-operator. My wife, she still owns her own truck and trailer, but the cost of fuel the past few years has actually caused us to sell the one tractor and the one trailer because it's just ungodly expensive. For instance, approximately 97% of everything that consumers buy at the store, the gas station, gravel for your driveway, whatever, has been brought by a semi-truck.
Right.
Okay. Now, the funny thing about it is diesel fuel is just a step above kerosene, all right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually a lower grade than gasoline, but it's virtually more expensive. Now, here's the thing. If it continues to rise at the rate that it's doing, you're going to see dramatic increases in everything, lumber, clothing, food, groceries.
Because just paying for the transportation to get it to the shelf is going to be such a big component.
Oh, absolutely, because, you know, the fuel keeps going up and up and up, and the companies aren't tacking on surcharges to these loads. They get delivered to the store, so everybody's making less.
Dwayne, you've already lost a truck and trailer there. How much further can it go before you're out of business?
Well, actually, I'm out of business. I went back into driving a company truck. I work for a major trucking company now.
Right. So it's already hit home in a big-time way with you, and we hear it. We thank you for that call from Charlotte, North Carolina. I want to welcome into our conversation for an economic perspective here Michael Mandel. He's chief economist for Business Week magazine. Michael Mandel, great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, glad to be here.
So here we are. Oil gone up like crazy, up 50% since the first of the year. Everybody sees what's happening with gasoline. Vijay Vaitaswaran says, well, it's not as high as it has been in real terms, historically, and yet the impact is there. We're beginning to really feel it. Are we at risk of the economy being knocked off its growth? So far, the growth rate's been pretty good.
I think we'll see a little bit of a slowdown in the economy, but I think the real impact is that, you know, in the past, we've had spikes in oil prices, and they've gone right back down again. But right now, people are trying to wrap their mind around the idea that these high gasoline prices and the high oil prices may be with us for a long time, or maybe permanently. And when that happens, what you start seeing is larger changes in behavior. And that could be the real big story. You know, we heard that from the previous caller in terms of selling off his truck.
Right.
Well, then you'll see things not being shipped quite as far because the transportation is more expensive. Mm-hmm. You'll see people adjusting what kind of cars and vehicles they buy, where they buy their houses. You'll see companies putting a lot more attention into energy research, which they haven't done. And so, really, we've lived for a long period of time in an environment where even when prices spiked, people expect them to come back down again, and that's what's really changing now.
It may not happen this time. But what about if we have that kind of big change? That's throwing the American economy in reverse from what we saw in the 90s, the huge SUVs and the McMansions and sprawling suburbs.
Right.
Can we make that transition in the kind of time frame that may be required without an economic meltdown?
Yeah, I don't think you'll see a meltdown. You'll see big disruptions. You'll see people, you know, you mentioned the McMansions. Well, the more space you have, the more energy it takes to heat and cool.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, people will realize that they've taken on not just the size of the house, but a much bigger bill than they expected, or a much longer commute. And what you'll see is much more attention by the automakers, whether they're U.S. automakers or Japanese automakers, to energy-efficient vehicles, which favors the Japanese hybrids. And then you could just go down the entire list of things. You know, a lot of the things that people talked about 20 and 30 years ago, like solar power, kind of stalled because the price of oil was so low. And what happens is that when the oil goes back, if the oil stays high, mm-hmm. all of a sudden, some of the things that didn't look so attractive before become more attractive.
Vijay, let me put that to you. We just had this huge energy bill come out of Washington a couple of weeks ago. Still, we're learning pieces about energy policy. I'm just looking at an article from yesterday saying that the Bush administration is going to abandon a proposal to extend fuel economy regulations to Hummer 2s, H2s, and other huge sport utility vehicles. That's just the opposite of this kind of response. There was a widespread critique that the energy bill didn't really put America on a new energy track. Is it possible that the market, that oil prices themselves, will whip the U.S. into a new relationship with energy?
Well, the market's the best hope we got, because I can tell you that Washington really isn't doing much good. That energy bill is an example of Washington at its worst. It essentially doled out what could amount to be up to $80 billion in pork barrel giveaways to the energy industry. It's no lobbyist left behind. That's how John McCain, the Republican senator, criticized the bill. Every industry got billions of dollars in giveaways. But, of course, just when it happens when lobbyists line up the biggest and most influential industries, oil and gas, nuclear, they got the biggest pieces of the pie. So in a sense, what happened was we retrenched the status quo with that bill. And that's exactly the opposite of what we needed to do with an energy bill. Renewables, efficiency, they got a few scraps at the table.
But can you adjust rationally to these higher prices without a government policy beneath that adjustment? Do you know what I mean? If we're pushed by market forces alone, does it make it an uglier picture or ultimately a more efficient evolution of our relationship with energy?
Market forces are a powerful tool. The people understand the money coming out of their wallets. But as your guest just said, in the short term, people don't have the ability to respond. For example, just because oil prices have gone up and gasoline prices have gone up, you can't stop picking up your kids at soccer. Mm-hmm. You still have to do that. You can't suddenly change your commute because that's just how you've organized your life. But what you can say, once you begin to accept the prices are going to stay high, if you really believe them, you might say to your spouse, you know, honey, maybe we should get a slightly smaller SUV next time. Mm-hmm. And you begin to change behavior over time. And that's how behavior works. With energy, we can't immediately make choices simply because we're locked into patterns. That's where government policy can help also. And this is where the energy bill didn't do, for example, it did nothing on fuel economy standards or other ways of trying to tackle that problem. You mentioned the Hummers issue, the big SUVs.
Yeah.
You're right. Right now, the administration is expected to issue new rules concerning fuel economy for SUVs, light trucks, and so on before the end of the month. And the latest rumor coming from Washington is that they're not going to tighten up on those gargantuan SUVs that we all like to, you know, poke fun at in the late night TV shows and so on. Well, this is a problem. Here's why.
It's pretty incredible.
When Congress enacted the fuel economy laws, they're called CAFE, the corporate average fuel economy standards, in the wake of the oil shocks of the 70s. It was one of the most successful programs in American history.
And we've just gone the other way. Michael Mandel, I hear you there, and we've got a break coming up. I want to hear you on this. Vijay's addressing the market forces here. If market forces put us on a forced march to change, is that bloodier and more difficult than a policy-fueled march?
It's the real question is where the policy has to go. And the policy, I don't think, is on fuel economy standards. It's on the R&D spending for the next generation of energy technology, which I think will turn out to be more important in solving our medium and long-term problems, which is really the key.
And Jack, you hear the prospects here, the policy, well, no show. And meanwhile, people struggling every day to deal with the new prices, and we're hearing from Mike and John and Vijay, maybe much more to come.
Much more to come. And, you know, if we look back, the Arab oil embargo of 1973-74 was a watershed moment in 20th century history. It divided the era of equality to the era of after equality. That was the moment when real incomes started to go down, when permanent changes downward in American life took place. And that's because oil is not just some commodity we buy at the, you know, it's not just the cheapest commodity we buy at the store at the store 24 or the, you know, Stop Quick,
right,
whatever.
Cheaper
it's
than
called.
Gatorade.
It is the elixir. It is the basic sort of tonic of our whole economy, and when prices stay up on that, it is a tax, a permanent tax on those on fixed income, on the poor. It takes money that could go into wage increases and absorbs it into profits for the oil companies and the oil producers. It's the lifeline of the economy, and its effects in 1973-74 were profound. And I'm just afraid that, you know, once again we may be heading for another one of these cycles where family incomes will effectively go down. partly because of these price shocks.
Bring on the crisis and see what happens to spending power. Vijay, Michael Mandel, Jack, please stand by. We take a short break here. We're talking about skyrocketing oil prices. Question for you, listener. How high does oil have to go to really get America's attention, to really pave the way for change? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about skyrocketing oil prices and their impact. Later in this segment, we'll look at Iraq's situation now, having missed its deadline on the new draft constitution. We're joined this hour by Vijay Vaitheswaran. He's global environment and energy correspondent for The Economist magazine, by Michael Mandel, chief economist for Businessweek. Jack Beatty is with us as well. You can join us. How high does oil have to go to get your attention? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Jim is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning to one and all. Two very quick things about the present state of oil. Of course, there's very little slack in the system, but the main culprit is there's a war premium on, and that also adds a speculation premium. The second part is the whole notion of threatening Iran is going to cause a lot of jitters in the Middle East, to say nothing about the whole flow of oil being stopped.
So never mind supply and demand, we've got a sort of geopolitical situation that looks risky on a lot of fronts.
Not only that, but just think of what the third world countries are doing. They cannot afford the price of oil, how it is taxing their economies, and that comes back in a loop to us when we need the coffee and all these inputs into our economic system. Think what that does to the whole loop.
Jim, good points all, and thank you for calling. Michael Mandel, how about the geopolitical side here? I mean, we've got between North Korea far from the oil fields and Iran and Iraq right on top of them, never mind Saudi Arabia. The level of risk on top of the fundamentals of supply and demand does seem extraordinary.
Well, absolutely, and partly what's going on here is that we're tapped into this black gooey substance, which is found in some less developed countries, in part because we're still using this very old technology. You know, the internal combustion engine was invented in the 1860s, and so there's this link. We have to import this because we're using an old technology, and this ties us into geopolitically unstable regions. Now, these regions have been unstable. Are unstable now, will continue to be unstable in the future. I can't view this as a temporary premium. I think that this is going to be permanently built into the system.
So when does that turn into inflation in the United States, inflation globally?
Well, it's interesting. You know, think about it this way: the money from the oil is flowing out to the oil-producing countries, and it's not just Saudi Arabia, it's Russia as well. And then what happens, these countries can't really use it, so the money comes back into the U.S., and so at the same time that it's raising oil prices, it's also pushing down interest rates. So it's a funny effect on inflation. I mean, we're not getting the full inflationary effect because the higher oil prices are being muted by the low interest rates, which show up in things like housing and the price of cars. So right at this point, you know, today the CPI was announced, and outside of energy, it was very slack.
Consumer price index, in spite of that,
and I think that that's what we're going to see. That this is really not our father's economy, where the high price of oil translated immediately into higher inflation. It's much more complicated in this kind of global economy.
And yet, if that premium just sits on top of what we've came to know in those lovely cheap oil 90s, impacts all over the place. Courtney's calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Courtney, you're on the air.
Let Las Vegas sprawl. It's good for America. I just think that in terms of the American model, it's been whatever's cheapest, whatever's fastest, do it. It's good for America. And I think that sort of economic model is what's really at stake right now.
So are you saying we're going to drive towards solutions with that or drive off a cliff with that? Is this the Thelma and Louise moment here, Courtney?
No, I'm just saying that our mantra, the Walmart nation that we are, is based on whatever's cheapest is best. And, you know, you guys have been talking about the whole equation of supply side versus demand side management, and we haven't dealt with the demand side. You know, we're trying to, how do we create cities that are efficient and with mass transit and all that kind of stuff, and it takes investment. It's more expensive. We're not an investment nation, and my main question, I guess, is going out to you guys, is do you think that this will make the Europeans in the long run, you know, their economic model prevail over our laissez-faire, you know, just think about the supply side. Don't think about...
Let me put that to you just for a moment. If we go to what's cheapest, but oil is no longer cheap and may not be cheap again for a while, do you think that that's going to change the way the United States uses energy? Or are we just going to drink it till it's dry and then come up May?
You pointed it out in a question. You said, do you think it's too late? Have we reached a point of no return? I mean, you know, we've sprawled. We're already out there. We have inelastic demand, as your speakers have talked about. I think that you know, a lot of signs are pointing to a real crisis in the American civilization. Our whole model, our whole economic model, is going to be impacted. You know, and I don't see it being able to make a quick adjustment.
Courtney, we've got it. Vijay, how do you respond? Inelastic structures out there in the form of great big houses, and at least for a while the cars were driving. Do you see enough cultural elasticity for the U.S. to take on what's coming energy-wise in this century?
I think Courtney's put his finger on one thing that's right, but I would disagree with something else. certainly, the caller's right about making investments in efficiency that we made a very different choice after the 1970s oil shocks than Europe and Japan did. We took away very different lessons. Those other big economies of the world invested much more in energy efficiency. They took on things like gasoline taxes, for example, and different kinds of measures, building efficiency codes, so that what they had after 20 years of experience with that kind of public policy experiment, including reinvesting a lot of those funds in mass transit, things that I think your caller would approve of, you have countries that are, broadly speaking, extremely wealthy. You know, people live very comfortably and well in Europe and Japan with high levels of income. These aren't poor countries, but they use significantly less energy per unit of GDP, per unit of economic output. And that is we have a 20-year history, sort of an economic trial, so to speak, of a time when America guzzled energy. We're at close to a 20-year low on fuel economy on our cars, for example. We use far more energy for every unit of economic output that we produce than does Japan. And so we've taken a different path. But those are public policy choices. We can make different choices in future if we learn the right lessons.
So that's where I agree with our caller. The evidence is there, but not necessarily doing it.
But I don't accept some of the gloomier part of his arguments. I don't think it has to be the end of American civilization. At the end of the day, we still are the most innovative place on Earth. We're a quarter of the world economy. Most of the world's innovations, intellectual property advances in the last 20 to 30 years have come from America. And despite how we've organized ourselves, which our caller doesn't like and which I also critique in terms of energy, this is where it happens in the last 30 years. If you look at what are the big disruptive innovations that have really taken over, let's say, the business world, it's really hard to find one in Europe except maybe Nokia and cell phones.
But you can't,
almost all of them have come from America.
You can't help wondering, though, if energy is our Achilles heel. Michael Mandel, your book was Rational Exuberance a couple of years ago. You're saying there was reason to be optimistic. With this oil piece now looming, are you still optimistic about the U.S. economy?
I'm still optimistic. What I said in the book, actually, was I identified energy technology as an incredible laggard that
that the energy technologies that we use are very backwards in the sense that that they haven't been improved. The one thing that was a big breakthrough was really nuclear power, and that turned out, at least temporarily, to be a dead end. It's impossible for us to imagine moving forward as a global economy without breakthroughs in energy technology. And I don't know what form that they come in, whether they come in the form of solar, whether they come in the form of improved nuclear, whether they come in the form of hybrids that really, really are competitive with existing internal combustion engines. But you have to, it's hard to look out 25 years in the future and imagine that you can have Chinese, Indians, Europeans,
right. Everybody with the lights on.
Everybody with the lights on. It doesn't make it. You can write down the numbers. It doesn't make any sense.
Michael,
there isn't enough energy out there.
We've just got half a minute left. Is $67 a barrel enough to get America off the dime on this, or is it going to take 100, 150?
No, it's not. It only begins to get people's attention, and where you need to look at is not the energy bill, but the amount that's spent on R&D, and that's what's dropped over the last 20 years, and that's where government can make the biggest difference.
Well, rev it up, folks, because it's hurting at the pumps, and it's going to hurt elsewhere before this is all over, if what we've heard this hour is correct. I'm grateful to all of you for being with us. Michael Mandel, Chief Economist at Businessweek Magazine. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Oh, glad to be here.
And Vijay Vaitheswaran, Global Environment and Energy Correspondent for The Economist Magazine. Vijay, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
Jack, last word goes to you, my friend.
Well, I live on Faraway Lane, so I'd better just be quiet about sprawl.
Yeah, and get out your cross-country skis, Jack.
Yes, right.
Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a look at the situation with Iraq's delayed constitution. This is On Point. The three major groups meeting to create an Iraqi constitution failed to come to agreement by yesterday's deadline. The Iraqi parliament voted to give them another week, extending the deadline to August 22nd now. Joining me from Baghdad to discuss the prospects for compromise is former U.S. Ambassador Peter Galbraith. Ambassador Galbraith, thank you for being with us.
Good to be with you.
So what are the prospects with 7 days now in an extension of these groups, Sunni, Shia, Kurds, coming to an agreement that they were not able to come to, despite all the pressure from Washington yesterday?
Based on what I've seen so far, and yesterday I was I spent the day in the House where the negotiations were taking place, I think it's extremely unlikely that an agreement can be reached in the next week. The problem is that the three sides are not just far apart, but they don't have a shared identity. They don't have a shared commitment to Iraq. They don't have shared values, and that makes it and they're deeply suspicious of each other, deeply mistrustful. It makes it very difficult to reach an agreement.
We see that the so-called sticking points are just about as big as they could possibly be. The role of Islam, how much central control or regional autonomy there's going to be, and oil. I mean, these don't sound like sticking points. They sound like the very heart of the matter.
Indeed they are. Last night, as the deadline was approaching, they started to go through the Constitution, see what they could agree on, and they never got beyond the first paragraph of the preamble. It was right there. The Shiites, who had been responsible for drafting the Constitution, had put back in some religious items that the Ayatollah Sistani would have a role in the Constitution. And that the Shiites were the majority. And, of course, the Sunnis and the Kurds said, well, you can't put the fact that the Shiites are the majority in the Constitution. And that was just the preamble.
If you are correct, Peter Galbraith, and they will not be able to come to agreement, even in another week or, as you describe it, in another month or more, are we at a crisis point?
We are at a crisis, and it's a crisis of our own making. Almost everybody who was following the Constitution, and almost all the Iraqis, thought that another 6 months was required, that to try to do it in secret among the leaders was not going to work, But the Bush administration was adamant about the deadline. The president took a gamble, and basically it looks like he's going to lose that gamble.
So if this constitutes a crisis, if even a week from now we're not able to see agreement, or it's an agreement on a document that's so vague on essentials that it's meaningless, how is this situation likely to play out? If we're in a crisis, how is it likely to continue to unfold?
Well, there are some mechanical steps that will take place in a week. If there is no agreement, then the National Assembly is dissolved and there'll be new elections. The problem is that it will then become even more difficult to reach a constitution because the current assembly consists of basically Shiites and Kurds, the Sunnis having boycotted. If the Sunni Arabs now participate, there will be three groups with diametrically opposed views, and it will not be possible for two, as it is now, to come to an agreement on a constitution. But the core problem goes beyond that. You have the Shiites, who are the majority. They want to create an Iranian-style Islamic state in all of Iraq, or failing that, in their own federal region in the south. The Sunnis want a centralized Iraq because they remember the days until 2003 when they ran Iraq. Mm. And the Kurds don't want to be Iraqis at all. They want their own separate country. 98% of them voted for independence in January. So they don't want any power at the center. They want the constitution to ensure that they have their own army and their own resources, their own oil. And the Kurds, for example, they have everything they want now. There's no reason for them to agree to a constitution that provides less. Shiites also, they're doing what they want to do right now.
You're describing a pretty grim confrontation of interests. If it's not to go to civil war, what can you picture as a possible resolution here, Peter Galbraith?
Well, the first point is that there is a civil war in Iraq right now, and it's being fought between the Sunnis and the Shiites. There are ever-increasing numbers of sectarian killings. But I thought before this began that it was a mistake to try to produce a constitution because it highlights differences that can be solved practically. The regions in the center have been working on oil, but when you ask the question of who owns the oil, then they have diametrically opposed views. The Kurdish military, the Peshmerga, has been cooperating with the center in fighting the insurgency, but if you go to a constitution, then you have to resolve the question of whether there's only one Iraqi army or several. And these questions don't actually have to be answered formally.
Ambassador Gabriel, we've just got half a minute here. Are you saying that there will be no united Iraq, that is a pie in the sky?
There is no united Iraq. The country has, in fact, broken apart. The important thing now is to manage that process. I don't think any parts declare independence, but so that they can coexist. But the idea that you can build a unified state, that is pie in the sky. Trying to do so is very dangerous, and it risks conflict. It risks the kind of stalemate we see today.
And there's the latest from Baghdad. Ambassador Galbraith, thank you for joining us. Peter Galbraith, former U.S. ambassador to Croatia and currently a senior diplomatic fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation in Washington. He spoke with me from Baghdad. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.